America, and to all of our listeners all over the world, you're listening to yet another exciting edition of Let's Weekend. I'm your host and the most, Brandon Perkins. Joining me as always is Chris Selige. Say hi to the good people, Chris.
Hello.
Yeah, we got kind of a small crowd tonight, and that's partly due to the fact that if you notice the date, we're actually doing this a day earlier than we normally would. And that's actually because, believe it or not, Chris doesn't have to work this weekend, but I do. So because of that, we had to move the show back a little bit to Friday. But that's all good, because we sure as hell did not have a lack of stuff to talk about, because as usual, you would be shocked at the amount of things that can happen in a single week, especially when awful people are involved, and especially when we're inching closer and closer to Pride Month, and all of the usual suspects are having their little moralistic pearl-clutching hissy fits about it. But that's not, of course, all that happened. We got some other stuff. We have a very unfortunate, but also one that had been kind of expected, celebrity death. We may just manage to save the economy before we end up defaulting on our debts. Just maybe. Fingers crossed. People are still getting easily fooled by AI-generated images. And this one in particular actually almost very briefly crashed the stock market. We'll explain that. And also, you remember the LA Dodgers doing something really boneheaded last week? Well, they've actually sort of done an about face and realized how badly they screwed up, and now they're, well, we'll get to it. Of course, we got a bunch of entertainment related stuff, including a couple of trailers, and all that and more we'll have for this week's episode of Let's Weekend. But before we do all that, let's start off, as we always do, with all the things we've been doing this week, as is tradition, and is also as tradition. Chris is the first one on the chopping block. So, Chris, what have you been doing this week?
Just enjoying things, I guess. The weather's been all right here.
Yeah,
this week.
Same here. It's been like in the 70s for most of the week, so.
Yeah, it was really nice yesterday when it was in the 40s for the morning. Like, slowly creeped up to the mid-60s.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of where I really like the temperature at, like, the 60s. Mm-hmm. It's not too hot, not too cold. But that was fun. But, yeah, for things I've been doing, been watching some older stuff with Futurama coming up, the new season.
Mm-hmm.
I decided to watch or rewatch Futurama.
Mm-hmm.
I am in season 3, the start of season 3. War is the H word. That is a very good episode where to get a 5% discount on gum, Fry and Bender decide to enlist in the military, and then war gets declared against a planet they don't, that nobody knows anything about.
Yeah, unless, you know, war were declared, and then the alarm goes off, and he's like, "What's that?" And he goes, "War were declared." Yeah.
Yeah, it's like a spoof of Starship Troopers and MASH.
Yeah, and I think also a little bit of the Forever War as well, because it's essentially, you are right, though, it is mostly a Starship Troopers parody, and God, if they don't nail it.
That's a very good show, especially those first 4 seasons. The reason is because a lot of the best Simpsons writers of the late 90s, you know, went with Matt Groening to start a new show. And they did this and just nailed it. And mostly did a good job with the newer stuff, though I haven't seen a ton of it, but I'm curious to see how that stuff holds up in comparison. I think the one episode I know of is like some commentary on iPhone mania. Stuff, but that's about as much as I can recall from that stuff outside of like the movies they did. But that stuff's been fun. The other thing I've been watching is some American Gladiators, the classic American Gladiators.
Mm-hmm.
There's a YouTube channel, an official one, that has been just posting episodes from the show. And I've been just grabbing those and watching them. The weird thing is they put up the very first episode, season one, episode one, then move immediately to season two. So I'm sort of confused with that, where that stuff went. But otherwise, you know, the fun part of the show is that every episode is sort of part of this tournament. They're setting up between two male competitors and two female competitors, as they do, you know, various sportsy combats, you know, challenges against these gladiators.
Mm-hmm.
Generally former athletes and such. There's like one guy in the that was like a weird, not a very good actor, but he did some like D&D VHS thing. That he was a part of. He played the, you know, like the barbarian for that video D&D sort of thing. That is not good, but it's very much of its time. But yeah, that stuff's still pretty fun. But for games, I've been watching some or playing some Power Wash Simulator. Still playing it on PlayStation as I'm working my way through it. The neat thing with the Tomb Raider and Final Fantasy campaigns. That gives you some extra money you can earn while you're going through the campaign stuff, where you're kind of really strapped as you're reaching the... I'm at the point where I can get the last washer, but it's $5,000. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just like, I wonder how fast I can get this without, you know, playing as much of the campaign as I as I would normally have. Then, you know, work my way up to the tri-tip sprayer nozzle.
Because
apparently not having that means you don't have that in the special campaigns with the Final Fantasy Tomb Raider stuff. So that's been a little bit tougher that way, but still enjoying that a lot. But yeah, also been playing some more Tears of the Kingdom. I got all the towers done, so that's good. The one was a little tricky. With the cave, with the snowy area where it's snowed in. So you can't physically get to it. So you kind of have to go down in these caves and do some stuff down there.
Yeah.
Which was neat. Though it's weird having all these diaries. You're like, oh, we had to go, you know, in here to stay warm and all this. And then you go around, you don't find any of them anywhere. So it's like, okay, why did they have these diaries here about their expedition in here? I guess maybe they went somewhere else that Link can't go, but I don't know. But yeah, that was a fun bit of the game. Now I'm kind of working my way through the chasm, the chasms into the depths, and finding some interesting architecture. Because the first place you go is probably through the main one near the landing, where, you know, Robbie is tasking you to go down there so you can get your phone upgrade or your camera upgrade for the Pura pad kind of thing. And that's like, oh, these, you're just wandering around and there's, you know, these little campments where the Bokoblins and all them are hanging around doing their thing like they do up on the surface level.
Yeah.
But the other area I went to had more castle structure stuff around and like elevator stuff to go up and down.
Yep.
All that kind of weird stuff that I was like, well, this is weird and also challenging to deal with, getting up and down and all that, especially with the main mechanic of that, of the chasm stuff, is that if you take damage from any of the gloom or any of the enemies, it's permanently lost until you can essentially light a bonfire with one of the tower equivalents for underground. So that was definitely a thing I had to do in that area, because there's one of those right in the middle. So I'm just sitting here taking shots with my bow and all that. But yeah, that's been fun still to play around with. Let's see. And the other game I'm playing a bunch of is Dredge. Still working my way through that. Managed to finish one area's whole quest line, at least as far as I could tell, where you find this guy that's whose plane crashed on this like swampy area where these weird mind flayer type enemies are swimming around. They kind of require you to not move at all once you see them start popping up out of the water. Otherwise, they start chasing you and, you know, increasing your sanity effects, that stuff. But he tasks you with getting him specific fish to make bait for them, to get him caught in these traps that will, I guess you just like bombs to kill him. You just bring him pieces of meat to confirm that they're dead. So I did that stuff to finish off that area. Now I'm dealing with another area that has like a big giant fish that's swimming around, but they have little versions that try and get into your net, your trawling net, to slow you down, at least until you run over these like volcanic vents, air vents, the hot air vents that spew out of the water. They're afraid of that, so there's stuff there to do. They did make a change in a recent update. They had these random guys you find in robes that are like, I need this fish kind of thing. And I guess if you wouldn't necessarily figure this out right away, that it's a time limited thing. Cause you're not always, nothing else is time limited in this game. So you might play, you know, be like, okay, I'll see if I find one of those around here. And then you come back and they're dead cause you obviously didn't get them fish. So that's a fun little thing. But they fix that so that it doesn't like cancel out, that you can't do it, but it doesn't count against you, I guess. It's just like, we're just going to act like you did it anyway, kind of thing. Cause it's kind of a not great design decision. But, the other thing they did is that you could find or purchase some research parts. But they basically made that stuff respawn in the shop basically every time you come back. So that you can unlock all the upgraded nets and crab traps and engines and all this stuff more easily. Because I think a lot of people were just beating the game without unlocking the higher tier stuff as easily as they wanted, that kind of thing. Like and the skill points I've done to upgrade my ship, I've done them all so far. So it's like, I got all that stuff unlocked for extra spaces for nets and motors and lights and all this stuff. But unlocking the research stuff is taking a lot longer. So it's kind of like the balance of that stuff is not super great. Because I assume most people are able to fill out their ship skill tree stuff more easily than the research stuff. And so that's, I think, where they're making it a lot easier to do. So, like, that kind of stuff is things they've... And they also let you put markers down on the map now. So if you know, like, where cool stuff is, but you can't get access to it, you can make it easier to find that stuff instead of hunting around for it, that kind of stuff. But it doesn't show up on the compass or anything, which I think would be a good idea. But that's probably tougher than it seems, but... That's been pretty much it for me. So how about you, Brandon? What have you been doing?
Well, my gaming has been entirely still taken up with Tears of the Kingdom. And I have now finished two of the temples, both the Wind Temple and the Water Temple. And yeah, I've gotten that way. I'm also trying to sort of, because I realized after a while that I had been kind of neglecting the towers for a little bit, so I decided to go back and, you know, start sort of getting those activated. And like you've mentioned before, a lot of them are basically messed up for various reasons. Either someone steals something from them, or something goes haywire inside of them, or, you know, something from the sky stuff falls down and breaks something. Pretty much a lot of them. Not all of them, but a good chunk of them are like that. And some of them can be kind of infuriating to have to deal with. The one I specifically remember is the one where you had to go to the cave that was underneath it, and The thing about this cave is that it's just covered with, like, breakable rock areas that you had to get through. And if you're one of those people who didn't realize up to this point that you can basically attach a boulder to one of your weapons and use it to break those boulders, yeah, I don't blame you. Because bombs and bomb flowers are, like, really hard to get in contact with in this game for some reason. But yeah, I eventually managed to get through it. And it's hard because there's actually like three or four different pathways in that cave area you don't realize are there. And what you basically end up having to do is about midway through the two paths you go through, you have to start hitting at all the other areas. And you'll eventually find like a third area with a very like circular pattern on the ceiling that you then use to, you know, ascend up through. And it'll land you inside of the actual tower, and then you find out why the door isn't opening. It's because for some reason there's these two big sticks that are like holding the doors closed. Basically, they're just like wedged on the sides of them. But that game just still manages to continue to impress me in a lot of different ways. And I do love the fact, one of the things I do really love about this game is that, unlike in Breath of the Wild, where the champions just only really showed up when you had to use one of their abilities, here technically they're not there. They're like their apparitions are there, but they're always with you throughout the entire game. They're actively helping you fight all of these monsters, and, you know, it's nice to actually have like a party with you instead of just being by yourself. That game is just a great game. And I am loving every bit of it. Next up, I've also been doing a lot of reading lately. I finished Blood Meridian, and goddamn, that book is just a experience is the best way I can describe it, because it is dark from the beginning, and it just gets darker and bleaker as the book goes on. But it is absolutely engaging, and you cannot look away right up to the very end, where just some awful shit really happens. So I put that aside after I'd finished it, and I decided I wanted to do a little bit slightly lighter reading. So I started reading the books of a gentleman by the name of Carl May. Well, I say Carl May. I think his last name is actually pronounced Mai. So it's Carl May. And Carl May is to the Germans what Jules Verne is to the French, in that he's probably like the most popular and translated of all German authors, like, you know, next to like, say, Goethe or, you know, someone else like that. Maybe Nietzsche. I don't know. But he is, his whole life story is just absolutely crazy. He was born like in the like mid 1800s in, I think it was Saxony. And he was like a lifelong individual who like suffered from like a kind of like Munchausen syndrome. He was constantly getting arrested for like a long time for like petty crimes and stuff, like larceny and, you know, stealing just random shit and pulling like, you know, like scams and stuff. Like, he would go to like a village and go to like a ritzy hotel under like a false name, and then he would like go to like the most expensive room they had, and he would like get room service and order like expensive furs and stuff. And he's like, no, I'll pay it on credit. Cause, you know, he would claim to be like a rich doctor or whatever. And then he would just skip town afterwards. But yeah, he got arrested a bunch of times. And eventually what happened is that he got to a point where he was like, you know, I'm really good at coming up with bullshit. I should try being a writer. And that's what he ended up doing. He became probably one of the most, if not the most popular German writer of his day. He wrote, and prolific too. The collected like work of his fills, like, I think it, last I checked, it was like 93 books. So yeah, he wrote a lot. And he wrote in like various genres. He wrote like, you know, when he started out, he wrote what were called colportage novels, which are, I guess the best way to describe them is that they're like long serial novels that were delivered, you know, through the mail in like installments. And they were like of several thousand pages in length. And he would do stuff like, he wrote like crime fiction, humorous stories about, you know, an ore mining village in Germany, historical adventure stories about one of the younger princes of the pre-German Confederacy days. But the one thing he became most famous for is he wrote westerns. Well, he wrote adventure stories. He called them travel stories. And he wrote two big cycles of them. One of them is called the Orient Cycle because they were travel stories that happened everywhere from like the Balkans all the way up to like, you know, China. And then he wrote what are called the Western stories. And basically all of these stories involve a guy who basically like an idealized version of Karl May himself. And he would basically end up in these places. He would, you know, he would be going there to like work for like in the Western stories, he's going there to work as like a land surveyor. And like the first day he's there, he gets into a fight in the saloon and manages to knock a guy out with one punch. And so everybody nicknames him Old Shatterhand. And later he gets attacked by a band of Apaches, wherein he meets a guy named Winnetou, who becomes his blood brother. And the most famous of these Western stories is called the Winnetou Trilogy, which is made up of like a original novel and then a couple of two other books that are like fix up books of his. And what's really fun about these books is the fact that they read up like a person who literally is making it up as he goes along, because that's literally what he's doing. He's making this shit up as he goes along. Karl May never went to the Orient or to America until he was well established as a writer. So everything that he was doing, he was basically pulling out from research materials he could get his hands on and just his own imagination. And if you pay attention, it really shows. But here's the other thing. After these travel stories started getting popular, Karl May's Munchausen syndrome really took over, and he started claiming that, no, I am in fact Old Shatterhand himself, and these stories are all true, and these are all my real-life adventures. He even went to like a gunsmith and got like models of the guns that both Old Shatterhand and Winnetou used, claiming that they were the real, you know, rifles of his rifle and his friend Winnetou's rifle. Which is especially funny because the thing about the Old Shatterhand's rifle, which is called the Henry Carbine in the book, is that it's basically, they literally call it in the magic gun. Not because it's literally magic, but because it's far more advanced than any kind of gun that existed at the time existed. It essentially was like a lever action, you know, repeater rifle that could shoot 100 rounds without reloading. and you know, if you see the picture of like the actual rifle that he had made, you can obviously tell this would not work, because even in the books, the way that the rifle is described as working is that the magazine that goes into it is like spherical in shape, which is the only reason it's able to like keep pumping out rounds at that rate without having to reload. And yeah, it's just, it's hilarious how he just like, it's like he basically lost touch with the whole concept of like what fantasy and reality are and where they divide. And then what happened is like right around the turn of the century, he decided to actually like go out and go to these places that he claimed to have previously gone to. And he straight up had like a mental breakdown while he was out there, because he started going to these places, seeing that they were not anywhere near close to the way he had described them. And he just snapped, basically. And when he came back, he basically became kind of a, I don't want to say he became like a religious fanatic, because that would kind of that would honestly kind of oversell it. Mai did become like a very super religious dude when he came back after it. And it's mostly because he sort of had this, I guess you could claim he had some kind of epiphany while he was going around. And he started preaching pacifism. And he kept writing up to this point, and he kept doing other stuff. And like the last few books he published are like extreme, have like strong, like spiritual sort of allegorical undertones in them. One of these books is called Genistan and Urdistan, and it's literally straight up like a, it's basically an isekai, more or less. His character that his sort of self-insert character that's in the Orient Cycle ends up getting transported to this plant fantasy planet that's supposed to surround a star called Sinastra. That's supposed to be like several light years away from Earth. And it's about like how, you know, humanity is progressing from a base state to a more spiritual. It's really complicated. But the point is, these books are very fun to read. They're also very, like, very much like of their time and place. And it is amazing reading these things and just seeing the, I guess you could call the combination of like imagination and hubris that goes into them. And now you're thinking, okay, so what's the deal with all this? Like, okay, why is this guy still remembered? Well, among other things, his books have still remained extremely popular. The most famous German, the most famous and most profitable German cinematic franchise is based on these books. And, you know, they made just millions of Deutschmarks and euros when they were being made. The other thing is that he was apparently Hitler's favorite author, which goes to show you how much fascists are just terrible at reading comprehension. Because again, as I need to repeat, Karl May was a pacifist, and he was generally opposed to the kind of, you know, rampant imperialism of his day. Now, that's not to say he was somehow free of racism. The dude was still like a German dude in the 19th century, and there's definitely a degree of like cultural chauvinism that you can see in these books. But they're also surprisingly progressive in ways you would not expect. But yeah, that's what I've been doing. But I mentioned like the books that are published, they're like 94 in length. There's like 94 books. Obviously, not all of those have been translated into English, but a good number of them have. And you can get them like very easy on Amazon. Yeah, that's what I've been doing. And just, you know, Memorial Day shit as well. Chris, have you got any plans for Memorial Day this week? I mean, this weekend?
Not really.
Yeah, I don't really either, because, again, I have to work tomorrow. For those who don't know, I work at a grocery store. As you can imagine, Memorial Day's kind of a busy time, because everybody's trying to get their barbecue shit before the day comes. So fortunately, I'm working the evening shift, so that won't be too bad. But yeah, that's what I've been doing. So you want to add anything before we move on?
Nope.
Alrighty then. Well, it is now time for everybody's favorite part of the show, Brandon's Random Factoid. And this week, since, you know, it's Memorial Day, and that seems to revolve around food and everything, and especially eating an exorbitant amount of grilled meats of some kind, Chris, have you ever been a fan of Jell-O?
I've enjoyed it at times.
Yeah, Jell-O, it can be good, but, you know, it's Jell-O is kind of this, it's emblematic of a certain kind of American food. And that it's, at least the kind we get here in the U.S. is very artificial in nature. But gelatin itself, like what is the essence of Jell-O, is not like artificial or chemically at all. It actually comes from something fairly, you would think, fairly mundane. Jell-O, or what we call gelatin, is actually what happens when you basically cook off the collagen from animal body parts. So it can be anything, you know, like just regular, like pork, for example, or it can be like, you know, pig's trotters and, you know, fish parts and stuff like that, basically. Bones in particular are a really easy way to get gelatin. And basically, as far back as people started to realize that you could use gelatin and make it into some kind of food stuff, they started adding like fruits and stuff like that to flavor it. So, you know, in the 18th century, you know, hot French cuisine, there were numerous recipes for Jell-O. Involving, you know, fruits and sweets of various kinds and sweeter vegetables and things like that. But, Chris, have you ever had aspic before?
I don't know what it is, so maybe without knowing it?
You might have without knowing it, but if you don't know what it is, I'll go ahead. Aspic is what happens when you take gelatin and make it savory, usually using some type of meat stock or broth, and then set it in a mold, and then usually, and this is the worst part, you use it to encase other ingredients, usually solid stuff.
Oh, like the gelatin, like dessert kind of thing, but for not dessert.
Yeah, and if you've ever, like, taken a look through, like, old-timey cookbooks, especially from, like, the 1940s, 50s, all the way up to, like, the early 60s, you see a lot of this shit. And it is nasty, nasty, nasty.
It's like one of those things you see in, like, old magazine adverts and such. Yeah. Where you're like, ugh, these people needed something better.
And there's obviously stuff to talk about that. But before we get to that, we'll sort of talk a little bit about the history of aspic, because aspic actually has a bit of a longer history than like sweeter gelatins we would expect. The first and earliest known existence, you know, like written existence of an aspic, actually comes from the Kitab al-Taqi, which is an Arabic cookbook from the 10th century. And it contains a recipe for something called karas, which is a aspic that's made from fish. Basically, they would boil lots of fish heads with, you know, vinegar, parsley, cassia, whole onions, rue, black pepper, ginger, spikenard, galangal, clove, coriander seeds, and long pepper. Because remember, this is the Orient where they've got all the spices. So they could do that. Then they would color the resulting dish with some saffron to give it a radiant red color. And then they'd serve it on a plate. And by all accounts, it was actually pretty good, and it looked amazing. Ibrahim Ibn al-Mahdi, who famously described it, a dish of karas that had been made with carp from Iraq, and he described it as like ruby on the platter, set in a pearl, steeped in saffron, thus like garnet, it looks vibrantly red, shimmering on silver. In fact, and like I said, meat aspic was made even before, you know, the fruitier gelatins we think of. In fact, by the Middle Ages, they had discovered that they could thicken meat broth and use it to make it into a jelly. We got a recipe from like 1375 in the La Viandière, which is one of the early French cookbooks that describes this. And then what happened is in the 18th century, well, I say 18th, it was actually the early 19th century, a gentleman by the name of Marie-Antoine Carême, who was like the godfather of fancy pants, ultra-rich French cuisine, created the concept of what's called chaud de froid, or hot cold, which is when you take a hot dish, serve it cold using an aspic sauce, which would then be put on, you know, fish or poultry or ham, you know, things like that. And then by the early 20th century, it started to make its way over to America. And even before then, like in Europe, it had started to become a feature of like extreme high society, like highly expensive cookery. Several shows back, I talked about the Dinner of the Three Emperors, which happened in the late 1800s. And I described, you know, one of the dishes involved them making aspic that was flavored with like tapioca and coxcomb. So yeah, it's like it was part of like the, just the haughtiest of the Hauts cuisine. And then in the 20th century, it started to make its way over here, where it started to make become like a feature of like ultra ritzy dinner parties, and like during the Jazz Age, like the Roaring 20s. And then, of course, the Depression happened, and then, you know, everybody had to cut back once the Depression happened. And then after the war, you know, all the rationing ended, and suddenly we were just, you know, swimming in money again. And, you know, all the petite bourgeois and the nouveau riche decided they wanted to try and make themselves, you know, Gatsby style by being as over-the-top expensive as they could. And one of the things they adopted was aspic. And this started to trickle down to, you know, housewives all over middle America and the suburbs and all that stuff. And so those sudden images you've got of, you know, people trying to make, say, a mock aquarium where they cook whole fishes and then put them in like these enormous tanks filled with aspic so it looks like they're, you know, having a swim, even though, you know, they're stock still, you know, stuck in it. Or, like, here's one I particularly remember that's just nasty. Taking a banana and then wrapping pieces of, like, sweet ham around it, drizzling some cheese, and then encasing the entire thing in, like, a layer of aspic. Yummy fucking yum. Dig in. But, yeah. It's one of those things where, like, you know, it's very common for pretty much any type of society with, like, a strong, like, class inequality. You know, suddenly the nouveau riche want to try and show off as much as they can, so they basically throw money at foodstuffs that frankly add nothing to the flavor or, you know, the texture or anything. It's just to show off how rich they are. And aspic is especially one of those things. Now, fortunately, aspic has largely fallen out of favor with the type of, you know, nouveau riche type stuff. It's still kind of traditional in parts of the world, especially like in Eastern Europe, you know, like in, you know, Croatia or Russia or the former Yugoslavia, the Czech Republic, Latvia, Lithuania, Slovakia, Belarus, Georgia, Ukraine, stuff like that. Usually what they'll do there is they'll like take aspic and like coated around like force meat, you know. In Russia, they have something called kolodets. Well, they'll like you know, encase like chicken meat around it, and then they'll season it with like horseradish and mustard, you know, stuff like that. So it can be good. It's not like aspic is completely useless. It can be good, but so much of 20th century cooking was so overwhelmed with trying to show off that it kind of ruined the concept of aspic for just whole generations of Americans. And frankly, I don't blame them. But yeah, that's aspic. It's kind of gross. And that has been yet another installment of Brandon's Rant Factoid. Now, with that out of the way, it is now time to move on to the show proper. And as always with the show proper, we start off with our assholes of the week. And get ready, folks, because we got about 6 or 7 of them to go through. And the first one we've got is Stuart Rhodes, the founder and leader of the Oath Keepers, who was officially sentenced to 18 years in prison this week. Seditious conspiracy.
Yep. Finally getting what was been coming to him.
Yep.
Because the Oath Keepers have been a shitty group for a long time.
A long time.
But yeah, he is finally going to prison. I don't even know how old he is, but he is gray-haired and all that, so I'm assuming this is going to put him into at least his late 60s.
Mm-hmm.
So that is good. I don't know if there's any other charges for this, but the judge for this or the jury for this, or no, the judge this made sure the prison term was as long as they could make it.
Mm-hmm.
And it will probably influence Enrique Tarrio's, you know, sentencing when that happens.
Yeah.
As well as some of the other people that were involved in this that got the similar charges. Because I think they mentioned here later that Kelly Meggs, a co-defendant, also convicted of seditious conspiracy and a former leader of Oath Keepers Florida chapter, was sentenced to 12 years in prison.
Mm-hmm.
He described the separation from his family members as his attorney, Stanley Woodward, asked the judge for mercy.
Mm-hmm.
I think they wanted like 12 months at most, but they gave him 12.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause as also in that trial, they heard, you know, accounts from police and congressional staffers who are still dealing with the after effects of that, that whole ordeal.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's yeah, the Justice Department had asked Rhodes to serve 25 years in prison. His legal team requested time served, about a year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
Just like, nope. Good riddance to him.
So, yeah, he is going to go to jail for a while. Oh, by the way, I know we got on here, but say it now. You know the Q shaman? The guy who...
Yeah.
Yeah. He got a prison. He got out of prison this week.
Yeah.
So he's walking around free now.
I think he's in home confinement.
Yeah, he's home, he's on house arrest for right now. Let's I would hope maybe he's learned something from this ordeal, but I don't know. I guess we'll see. But speaking of assholes getting what's coming to them, you remember that one guy during the January 6th insurrection who like went into Nancy Pelosi's office and put his feet up on his desk and stuff? Yeah, he's going to prison for about 4.5 years.
Yeah, it's well worth the recline there, buddy.
Mm-hmm.
His name is Richard Bigo Barnett.
Yeah,
became one of the big faces of the January 6th insurrection.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, got what was coming to him because, 54-month sentence for Barnett, a retired firefighter from Gravette, Arkansas.
Mm-hmm.
Comes after he was convicted at trial on 8 counts, including felony charges of civil disorder, obstruction of an official proceeding for, you know, trying to stop the certification of Joe Biden's victory over Trump.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the claim is that he testified that he was going with the flow and struck a pose after news photographers told him to act natural. He told the judge that joining the riot was an enigma in my life and that he regretted, but said prosecutors wanted him to be remorseful of things I did not do.
Mm-hmm.
January 6th was a traumatic day for everyone, not just law enforcement. He's vowed to appeal his conviction, testified at trial that he was swept along with the crowd into the Capitol, was looking for a bathroom when he unwittingly entered Pelosi's office, and encountered two news photographers. But yeah, the, let's see, the district judge did not believe this, because it was established at trial that Barnett brought into the Capitol a stun gun with spikes concealed within a collapsible walking stick. Barnett also took a piece of Pelosi's mail and left behind a note that said Nancy Bigo was here, punctuating the message with the sexist expletive. Before leaving Capitol grounds, he used a bullhorn to give a speech to the crowd, shouting, "We took back our house, and I took Nancy Pelosi's office."
Mm.
You know, so definitely he was just swept in and looking for the bathroom and ended up where photographers forced him to do that pose. So, yeah, that's the... I think they kind of sunk him on this.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, that's... he's going to go to prison for a few years.
Mm-hmm.
And have to enjoy it.
Yeah. Have fun with that, jackass. And now for companies basically just backing, you know, backing down to terrorists. Target has removed its Pride Month products after increased backlash and threats against employees.
They posted a big statement about this, saying that they were withdrawing some items over threats that were impacting our team members' sense of safety and well-being on the job. Which, you know, I would think maybe that would necessitate security at the locations that are getting these threats, or all of them. Obviously that would be a big expense, but also their target. They can afford that. They also said, given these volatile circumstances, we're making adjustments to our plans, including removing items that have been at the center of the most significant confrontational behavior. Like, I've seen a video of an older man talking with a security dude or at the Target after he, like, knocked all the clothes off of a rack.
Yeah.
Like, man, this dude must think he's the shit because he went into this one area and knocked the clothes off the rack.
Yeah.
Or it's like, what did that accomplish other than making somebody have to come over and fix up all those clothes again? Mm-hmm. But yeah, they're the latest company to back off of their commitment to at least rainbow capitalism.
Yeah.
Displaying these items to sell for people that want them.
Mm-hmm. For the record, the grocery store that I work for, we've had Pride stuff out for a little while, and we haven't gotten any complaints. So I'm not sure if that's just because I live in a part of Georgia that's relatively sane, or if it's just because people are specific, are, you know, these people are just fucking sheep and they're being pointed at, you know, where they need to go by the people they consider their leaders. I'm not sure, but
I'm pretty sure they're being told who to talk to.
Yeah.
Complain to, because they're probably getting email addresses and phone numbers to call and that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Because they claim to be these free thinkers, and yet, well, they obviously aren't, are they?
Yeah, but, we'll get to somebody later that is definitely one of those kind of sheep. But, mm-hmm. Yeah, they mentioned, like, one of the things being targeted is these tuck-friendly women's swimsuits that allows trans women to hide their genitalia, which is like, yeah, but also, guess what? Some women have extra baggage down there normally.
Yeah, they've been making tuck-friendly, you know, bathing suits for women and girls for a long time now.
Because not everybody's the same size.
Yeah, women's bits down there can come in different shapes and sizes, you know, and I'm not talking about, like, penis or vagina here. I'm talking, like, you know, flaps and things. They come in all kinds of different ways. I swear to God, these people talk about how much they want to defend the rights of women, and yet they know goddamn fuck all about how women's parts actually work.
Because they've never thought about it until the last year or so.
Yeah. Because again, they're fucking sheep.
Yeah, they're caught up in this culture war that, like, oh, they're only making this because of trans people. And it's like, no. There's plenty of reason for them to make this stuff for a long time.
Yeah. And now for some other shitty assholes. The Supreme Court of the United States has narrowed the scope of the Clean Water Act. Because, of course, they fucking did.
Yeah, and I think Chuck Schumer coined the term the MAGA Supreme Court. And people are like, oh, but it was voted 9-0. It's like, it was voted 9-0 for the specific case here of this, somebody that wanted bought property to build their dream house about 500 feet away from Idaho's scenic Priest Lake, a 19-mile stretch of clear water that's fed by mountain streams and bordered by state and national parkland. But yeah, 3 days after the Sacketts started excavating their property, EPA stopped work on their project because a couple had failed to get a permit for disturbing the wetlands on the on their land. And I was like, that stuff is pretty reasonable for this being private property of sorts.
Mm-hmm.
But now the nine justices agree that the Sacketts should prevail. They were divided 5-4 as to how far to go in limiting the EPA's authority.
Mm-hmm.
Writing for the court majority, Alito said that the navigable waters of the United States regulated by the EPA under the statute do not include many previously regulated wetlands. Rather, he said the CWA extends to only streams, oceans, rivers, and lakes, and those wetlands with a continuous surface connection to those bodies. And on the other side, do you want to guess which conservative judge joined the liberals?
I don't even want to hesitate to guess. Who was it?
It was Captain Alcohol, Brett Kavanaugh.
Wow.
Joined the court's three liberal members, disputed Alito's reading of the statute, noting that since 1977, when CWA was amended to include adjacent wetlands, 8 consecutive presidential administrations, Republican and Democratic, have interpreted the law to cover wetlands that the court has now excluded. Mm-hmm. Kavanaugh said that by narrowing the act to cover only adjoining wetlands, the court's new test will have, quote, significant repercussions for water quality and flood control throughout the United States. And yeah, mm-hmm. that's... And then, in addition to joining Kavanaugh's opinion, the court liberals signed on to a separate opinion by Justice Elena Kagan, pointing to the air and water pollution cases. She accused the majority of appointing itself instead of Congress as the national policymaker of the environment. So, mm. and yeah, Biden called the statement, the decision, disappointing.
Mm.
So, yeah, there you go for all that stuff. But they do have another one that was actually good. Involved a 94-year-old widowed grandmother in Minneapolis whose condominium was seized for failure to pay property taxes.
Mm.
A decision is important because Minnesota won about 20 states to handle the sale of such defaulted properties without sharing the proceeds with the previous owner.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, they owed $15,000 in back taxes, penalties, and fees. But when the county sold the condo for $40,000, she got none of the $25,000 surplus. The county argued that she would have gotten nothing regardless because she owed $61,000 in mortgage, unpaid homeowners association fees. But writing for the court, John Roberts said that the county unconstitutionally kept $25,000 that belonged to Taylor, and if she had gotten the money, she could have at the very least used it to pay off some of her other debts.
Mm.
It's like, that's actually a good decision.
Yeah.
Because the governments and police get plenty of leeway to steal your stuff.
Oh, yeah.
So there you go.
Definitely. Yep. So, yeah. And, yeah, so let's see. Then we have this thing that came out of fucking nowhere. Well, yeah, more or less out of nowhere. Okay, so the Texas House GOP-led investigative committee has recommended impeaching Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton on 20 different articles of impeachment. Now, this story is like an example of just a pack of wolves circling each other, basically.
It suggests how bad things were that
yeah.
the GOP is wanting to impeach one of their own.
Yeah, so a lot of people are suggesting that what helped kickstart this was that earlier this week, there was a there was like a meeting between, I can't remember if it was the state Senate or the state House. And one of the like major figures in there got up there in front of the microphone, and the dude was clearly just drunk, just sloshed off of his ass. Like, he was badly slurring his words. It was so bad, people were legitimately concerned he might be having like a medical episode, like a stroke or something. But no, it turns out he was just wasted. And apparently, the Texas State House kind of has a reputation for people just drinking like crazy during during events and, you know, during sessions. And I guess what happened is Paxton himself saw this and was like, you know what? I think this guy should resign. And that started off this huge firestorm between all these different parts of the Texas GOP. And out of that basically rose this revelation that he's apparently been under investigation for corruption charges and a bunch of other stuff. And it might be completely coincidental. I highly doubt it is. But this is the week where they finally decided to go public about it.
Yeah. Yeah, he definitely got word that they were nearing the end of this investigation.
Yeah.
And decided to go after the guy that was essentially leading this investigation.
Yep.
And then just, you know, did the whole thing where he claimed he was being drunk the previous week. That kind of thing, and then he needed to resign, and even called them the House's liberal Republican speaker.
Yeah, that is the part where it's like, oh yeah, they're gonna fucking get you for that. Yeah, they can tolerate a lot of awful shit, but that type of circular firing squad type shit, yeah.
Yeah, so they announced that they've been spending the last however many months quietly looking to Paxton recommended impeaching the state's top lawyer on 20 articles, including bribery, unfitness for office, abuse of public trust. They could have voted on the recommendation as soon as today. Mm-hmm. But I have not heard anything happening on that. But
I believe the impeachment trial is supposed to start Tuesday.
Yeah, but they, if he does get voted out, he would be forced to leave immediately.
Yep. Yes, he would.
And yeah, he's, and part of this kind of stems from him trying to use government money to pay off personal, like it was like $3 million to pay off something. I forget what it was for.
Mm-hmm.
Let me see if it says something here. The at stake for Paxton in the final days of the sessions, whether lawmakers will approve using $3.3 million in taxpayer dollars to settle a lawsuit brought by the attorney general's accusers.
Mm-hmm.
Of those that, you know, were working for him, that, you know, were getting abused and yelled at and all this, and that eventually just quit or, you know, force themselves out over the next, you know, days or months or whatever. But
mm-hmm.
yeah, this is a big deal. As let's see. Yeah, he put out a statement here. It is a sad day for Texas as we witness the corrupt political establishment illegitimate attempt to overthrow the will of the people and disenfranchise the voters of our state.
Yeah, fun part about that. Remember when he tried to help overturn the will of the people during the 2020 election?
Yeah.
I remember.
Yeah, calling the committee's findings hearsay and gossip, parroting long disproven claims. By moving against him, Paxton said, the rhinos in the Texas legislature are now on the same side as Joe Biden. It's like, I'm sure not at all they are. All of the Republicans in Texas hate Joe Biden.
Mm-hmm.
By the very nature that they're in office, because it's probably something they run on when,
mm-hmm.
for those at least that were up for election and since he's been in office. But yeah, he's on the fence here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he just got reelected into office about 7 months after easily winning a third term.
Yep.
Over challengers, one of them being George P. Bush.
Mm-hmm.
I assume the grandson of George W. Bush.
Or George H.W. Bush. I
forget which
one. The Bush dynasty is one of those things that has like deep roots in Texas, so it literally could be any of them.
I can't remember which one's the head of the family and who's the most recent president.
Mm-hmm.
I forget which one has the middle initials. That's always been my issue, but whatever. Yeah. This whole thing has to do with Paxton. It seems like he's a completely corrupt piece of shit.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
He's trying to act like he's been fighting the establishment when he is the establishment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's the hilarious thing about this.
Yeah. Frankly, I'm just happy they're fighting each other instead of uniting around something, because when they unite around something, nothing good happens.
Yeah.
So, and now for something that's just fucking infuriating and sad. In Mississippi, an 11-year-old boy called 911 for help, and then the cop showed up, and he answered the door. He shot the boy in the chest. Now, before you get concerned, the boy's fine. He survived.
Yeah.
He's going to have fucking PTSD for the rest of his goddamn life. But he survived. But yeah, this whole story is like, what the fuck?
Yeah, called for a domestic disturbance at his home, but happened to be the one that got the brunt of the issues.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, his mother told her son to call... call her mother and the police after the father of one of her other children appeared at their house in the early hours on Saturday, May 20th.
Mm-hmm.
She was concerned for her safety, but when the police arrived, things went terribly wrong. An officer ordered people out of the home and then shot this kid, Adarian, after he left his room. Her son doesn't understand what happened.
Mm-hmm.
His words to me were, "Why did he shoot me? What did I do?" And he just started crying.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, now the family wants to see, you know, the body cam footage, and
the cops are doing their damnedest to make sure they don't have to do that.
Yeah, and calling for the officer that fired the shots and the police chief to be fired. Not her. Well, who's this saying this? Probably their attorney. Said, no child should ever be subjected to such violence at the hands of those who are sworn to protect and serve.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, the Mississippi Bureau of Investigation is investigating this. So, there you go. Hopefully, they get the justice they deserve. And, you know, probably will sue the police department as well. So, get some money from them for all this awful shit that happened. So, there you go.
Yeah. But we do have some heroes of the week. Well, a hero of the week to talk about to wash all that horrible, horrible shit we just had to deal with. E. Jean Carroll. She is now expanding her second defamation lawsuit against Trump with new remarks from his CNN town hall because, of course, he can't not keep his mouth shut. It's compulsive. And,
yeah, this is a second lawsuit that was filed separately. They're seeking at least $10 million in damages.
Mm-hmm.
They've asked the court to expand the scope of this lawsuit in the wake of the CNN town hall proposed a set of amendments to her original lawsuit to add information about the verdict, along with the transcript of Trump's remarks at the CNN town hall broadcast on May 10th, the day after the jury's decision in the other case. You know, he claims, I never met this woman. I never saw this woman. Called it fake and made up and referred to her as a whack job and said other weird shit about her having a dog or a cat named Vagina and all that weird stuff. So, yeah, keep going after him. Take as much money as you can. That's the only way you get money from him is to either get hush money or sue him.
Yeah. So that is happening. So with that, we are now done with the show proper, and it's now to move on with the proper show proper. And unfortunately, we have to say goodbye to Miss Tina Turner, the queen of rock and roll herself. She died this week at the age of 83 from a long-time illness. She first, of course, became really famous as the part of the Ike and Tina Turner group who showed off her amazing singing voice, but sadly she was also part of a very torrid relationship with Ike Turner that was extremely abusive until she finally walked out on him. And then she made a massive comeback in the 1980s and became a huge pop sensation in her own right and continued to be a major popular and influential figure in music. So go ahead.
Yeah, she was 83. Been a big figure in the music industry for a long time.
Yeah.
Still did concerts relatively recently in like the past 10 years or so. So didn't necessarily, you know, retire as early as some people do. But yeah, she was just an iconic singer, much like, you know, Whitney Houston would be in the 90s and 2000s before she died, unfortunately. But luckily for Tina Turner, she got to live a full life.
Yep.
Did a lot of work, a lot of good songs. In a number of movies and that kind of stuff, too. So she got to try a lot of everything.
Yeah. So she was awesome. Sad to see her go. But
yeah,
she did leave us one hell of a legacy to continue to enjoy. So, yeah. See you later, Tina. You make heaven rock now. But, yeah. So, now we go on to the other news. It seems, and it looks like, that both President Biden and House Speaker Kevin McCarthy will get a debt ceiling deal done just before the U.S. defaults on June 1st.
Now they're saying June 5th is likely the day.
Yeah.
For that, Janet Yellen and the Fed have said that. So they likely have a little bit more time, but they seem like they're pretty close. They'll probably get done here sometime early next week. Likely to not take any of the extreme cuts that they that the GOP wants of Social Security and the food stamps and all that stuff. So hopefully that's the case. Like, I think the thing that would happen is like some sort of cap on spending stuff that's, I don't know how enforceable that would be in the end, but this would potentially push that stuff back another 2 years. So that would be good to see. So yeah, not really too much else to say on this because it's still not a done deal yet. Though Kevin McCarthy did just earlier post some stupid bullshit trying to frame this like a what do you say here? Do you have an extra $800 lying around? That's how much you more you owe as your share of the national debt since January 12th when I first called on President Biden to negotiate. His delay has real consequences. His default would be even worse. And it's like, that's not how that works.
No, I have to, I must constantly remind people, the national debt and the deficit is not you something you as an individual American should have any concern about. It's just none. Macro and economics do not work on the same slate of rules as your personal home finances do. And that misconception has been what has driven all of this, you know, deficit debt hawk bullshit pretty much since the beginning. The United States almost, you know, the United States virtually cannot go into, cannot default. It's virtually impossible. It is technically possible, but there would be a lot of other shit you would be needing to work about in the immediate, in your immediate life before that happens.
Yeah.
Because that it just, like, I know it gets a little complicated and trying to simplify it makes it seem completely insane. But the truth of the matter is the United States cannot go bankrupt. It just can't. It's physically impossible, especially considering that we have a sovereign fiat currency. As long as the faith and credit of the United States government stays good, is still in high thing, we can literally spend as much money as we want, and it will never hurt anything.
Yeah, like the fear that, like, oh, China's going to call the debts. It's like, they're not going to. It's not in their best interest.
China doesn't even own the majority of our foreign debt. Japan does. And that stuff, that the debt that they do have, it's not like something they can just get on the phone and call in for. It's all treasury bonds, and they only mature after a while. Debt is something that debt in like a government context doesn't work the same way as it does for personal debt. In an international context, debt is something that countries basically trade like trading cards.
Yeah. Just like companies that deal with debt just sell it off because they're like, I'm tired of dealing with this.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, do you know who holds the vast majority, and by vast majority, I mean like 70% of that debt? It's in the United States.
Yeah.
You want that debt to go up because it stimulates the economy. That money is going to Americans.
Yeah. It's used to pay for the stuff we're trying to do.
Yeah. So I know. It's just this whole, nothing has become clearer to me, the idea that we really are living in two different realities than when it comes to the concept of the national debt, because there's been a lot of really bullshit propaganda that the GOP and their allies have been spewing out over the last 50 years that has made people have these shockingly just wrong misconceptions about how the national debt actually works.
And then there's that stupid sign that purports to claim like what we owe, and it's like, that's not a thing that anybody has to care about.
No. No, it's not. But anyway, so that's probably going to happen. We'll see, I guess. Next up, GOP Senator Tim Scott is officially running for president, and he doesn't have a goddamn chance.
No. He's trying to be like the sensible Republican, but that's not...
That didn't work the last time.
Yeah, that's not going to outlast Trump. You're not going to convince Trumpers to go for you, especially because you're a black man from the South.
Mm-hmm. Like, look, you want to be the sensible Republican. That's not going to work until Trump is 6 feet underground. And even then, you know, his legacy is going to be on the GOP, tacked onto the GOP for years afterwards. So,
yeah,
I mean, that personality cult is running deep right now. he ain't got a chance.
Yeah, there's a long line of people right now that are running to get their ass whooped by Trump.
Mm-hmm.
Much like this next guy.
Mm-hmm. Ron DeSantis, current governor of Florida, and I believe he actually can't run again. I believe this is literally the last term he will have as governor. He, you know, unless he can somehow convince the House, the Florida, you know, the Republican-controlled local places to change the Florida Constitution so that he can run another term, which I wouldn't put past him, considering what he's been trying to do recently. But anyway, the point is, Ron DeSantis officially launched his presidential campaign on Twitter Spaces with Elon Musk, and it was a goddamn train wreck.
Yep. The details coming out of people that work at Twitter and know people that work there, mm-hmm. are like, they did no prep work for this.
Of course they didn't. It's Elon Musk.
Yeah, it's like, supposedly had about 600,000 people at most trying to get into this Twitter space, which is not that much. If you look up a list of the like top concurrent viewers on like Twitch streams, it's a lot of the top ones are at least 2 to 3 million people. Mm-hmm. So 600,000 should not be a challenge for them, other than it was not designed for that many people. And, you know, Elon Musk has, you know, cut a lot of the people that could have helped prepare for this sort of thing and beefed up their server infrastructure there to accommodate that many people. But it basically just kept crashing and causing issues and took like 25 minutes before they could even start this whole thing. And was just causing issues on Twitter itself. And yeah, that was a whole thing. And then from what people that managed to get in were talking about, like, there just being a lot of dead air because Elon and Ron just didn't know how to do anything, how to like properly hold a discussion or whatever on this thing. So that's a whole thing there of them just being two people that are not cut out to speak publicly, which is hilarious because both of them have jobs that demand it. And so basically Ron DeSantis just served up himself on a silver platter for Trump to just troll and attack him.
And it's not like Trump hasn't been trolling him like crazy already.
Yeah.
And viciously, might I add. This is Trump we're talking about. He does not hold back.
They started calling him Ron Disaster. So
yep.
That's the genius name now.
Mm-hmm.
But then he went on Fox News with Trey Gowdy. Again, brilliant decision-making to get on another very boring, poor public speaker person. And he was just on Ben Shapiro's show earlier today. So he's really picking winners here if he wants to get his message out there for this stuff. So, yeah, it's just been a disaster for him. He's getting clowned on every which way.
Oh yeah.
And of course, I guess the current rumor is that Trump's leaving his social media and coming back to Twitter, which is bad news for DeSantis because that means Trump's going to suck up all the oxygen in that race on Twitter. So there you go. Elon Musk is hitching his cart to DeSantis, and that's not going anywhere for the reasons we've talked about before, where he is just does not have the personality to overpower Trump in anything. His only thing is he is better effective legislation, I guess. He's a better as a fascist than Trump has been.
Because
mm-hmm. A lot of his time in the president was just ineffectual, just whining all the time.
Because
mm-hmm. you remember when they had the House, the Senate, and the presidency, they hardly got anything done.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't even get their replacement for Obamacare out there.
Mm-hmm.
That got taken down by John McCain.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. We'll see how this all evolves in the future. But yeah, the new CEO for Twitter is like, this was a great time for Twitter. And it's like, I don't know what the hell you were looking
for.
So there you go.
Yeah. But yeah. So yeah, moving on from there. The LA Dodgers, you may remember last week, they decided to disinvite the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence for Pride Night. Because of, you know, bullshit from like Marco Rubio, who is just a man who has no beliefs of his own, but must always claim that he does. And of course the Catholic League, but I mean, those guys are a bunch of blowhards. Who gives a shit about them? Yeah. Then the LA Dodgers kind of had a moment of lucidity when they realized, oh, right, this was really fucking stupid. And so they decided to turn around and they've reinvited the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence. So they're coming now. Yeah. And I was like, yeah, and both Rubio and the Catholic League, you know, were all acting, oh, so betrayed. It's like, fuck you. But yeah, they're now going to come. So
yeah, they posted a big statement about this saying, mm-hmm. after much thoughtful feedback from our diverse communities, honest conversations within the Los Angeles Dodgers organization, generous mm-hmm. discussions with the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence, Los Angeles Dodgers would like to offer our sincerest apologies to the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence, members of the LGBTQ plus community, and their friends and family. We have asked the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence to take their place on the field at our 10th annual LGBTQ plus Pride Night on June 16th. We are pleased to share that they have agreed to receive the gratitude of our collective communities for the life-saving work they have done tirelessly for decades. In the weeks ahead, we'll continue to work with our LGBTQ plus partners to better educate ourselves, find ways to strengthen the ties that bind, and use our platform to support all our fans who make up the diversity of the Dodgers family.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, good that they made this statement. They should have never put themselves in this position in the first place. That was the big stupid thing that they did.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, if you don't know the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence, they started basically as the AIDS epidemic was starting.
Mm-hmm.
And we're working to help the gay community and, you know, raise money through other means as well, especially mocking the Catholic Church because they were particularly, you know, a part of demonizing the gays that were getting, you know, AIDS and all this,
mm-hmm.
helping to create this whole situation where, you know, even the federal government didn't really talk about this AIDS epidemic until years later, you know, with the Reagans, once they got into power, that was a whole part of that where they act like they were instrumental, but they, you know, waited way too long for that stuff. Mm-hmm. That's sort of where the Sisters started with their mm-hmm. community work on that stuff. And they've been a great part of San Francisco and LA and other places
mm-hmm.
doing all that kind of work. So
yeah,
they're not mocking the Catholic faith. They're mocking the Catholic Church.
Yeah. Which is very easy to mock because of the horrible, horrible shit they have done in their history and to do.
Yeah. I didn't include it in Illinois that came out this week of thousands of children that were abused and that kind of stuff. And it's like, yeah, it seems like that's a perpetual thing in every state.
Mm-hmm.
It's like it was a core part of the Catholic religion for thousands of years.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go.
Yeah. And now just another example of just how awful shit is getting in Florida. A complaint from a single woman. And by the way, we're going to find out a little bit about this woman and find out she's got an agenda. One woman's complaint got Amanda Gorman's poem removed from a Florida school. If you remember, Amanda Gorman's was the young girl who read her poem at President Biden's inauguration in 2020.
Yeah, she was the youngest poet laureate
mm-hmm.
in the nation's history. They put out a book version of this poem
mm-hmm.
called The Hill We Climb.
Yep.
Now it's become very popular as a result of this story.
Mm-hmm. Because that's how this goes.
Yeah. But this one woman filled out a form objecting to this. They don't have the whole form here, but she managed to get the name of the book correct, but wrote down the author as Oprah Winfrey.
Mm-hmm.
Which is like, Oprah's a good 40 years or 50 years older than Amanda Gorman. Mm-hmm. That's how racist she is. She couldn't even figure out the name of this person before she put in this complaint. But didn't fill out, you know, large portions of this form. But did answer some parts, like, why do you object to this material? Wrote, it's not educational and have indirectly hate messages. Pages 12 through 13. Did you review all the material? Yes. We'll tell you that's not true.
Mm-hmm.
Are you aware of professional reviews on this material? I don't need it. Did not answer this. What strengths do you perceive in this material? Did not answer the mm-hmm. section to what do you object? You know, which she wrote in the next section there. So she's not a very smart person.
Mm-hmm.
For what age groups would you recommend this material? Not for schools.
Mm-hmm.
What do you believe is the function of this material? Cause confusion and indoctrinate student. It gets cut off.
Yeah.
In its place, what material would you recommend that would result in the same outcome? And nothing there. And the signature is like a big scribble.
Yeah.
And this woman, they have a name for it. I'm not going to say her name, but her first name is Daily. As in, like, you know, the Daily Mail.
Mm-hmm.
She is from Miami Lakes, has two children at this school, and people have looked into her. She has ties to the Proud Boys
mm-hmm.
and a conservative moms group on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
People have gone through her Facebook accounts like, yeah, there's lots of racist and anti-Semitic stuff was also on there, but lots of the shitty conservative memes and such through there. I think she apologized for some of the. There was anti-Semitic stuff because there was the
protocol from the other Scion. Yeah.
Yeah, that was the thing. But other stuff, she was like, no, I'm not apologizing for that. And then also, somebody managed to get a hold of her and ask her some questions and such. And she was very much like, I didn't read it, my kids read it for me. Kind of thing, like, I don't read things, and it's like, yeah, that's very obvious from everything that's going on here, and that kind of stuff. That's just like, all right, you're just a very shitty person who is completely caught up in the culture war that is going on around this stuff. As she also reported a few other books about Cubans and Black history stuff as well. I'm trying to see if I can find the article about this one. Yeah, it's a whole thing. You can definitely tell she is deep in the sauce of the culture war
mm-hmm.
and is trying to fight that through the limited ability that she has with this stuff. And yeah, it's just kind of one of those things that shows exactly how stuff is happening all around the country.
Mm-hmm. Next up, an AI-generated image of a bombing in the Pentagon got the stock market to briefly drop.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which got picked up by, like, Russia Today as well, and put out a bunch by them until they eventually had to apologize when, it became very obvious that this wasn't real. Because if you looked at the image, I don't know if they have, it might be in one of these tweets here, but you can look at details in the image where, like, the windows are all fucked up on the building. Details on the building are all fucked up because, you know, these AI-generated images have trouble with that kind of stuff, especially in the background. And, like, there's the gates around the Pentagon, as well as these, like, dividers start merging together in the image, that kind of stuff that makes it easy to tell this is fake.
Mm-hmm.
All that kind of stuff. But, yeah, it managed to cause the stock market to drop for a good 15 to 20 minutes or so.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of thing, as the stock market just sort of immediately reacted to the kind of news, if that was actually happening. Mm-hmm. But, you know, recovered pretty quickly once people started looking into this and being like, no, this is fake.
Mm.
And, you know, I think somebody, one of the big accounts, you know, paid for Twitter Blue and named themselves Bloomberg. Mm-hmm. To make it seem official. So,
yeah.
Good job, Elon Musk. You helped tank the economy.
Briefly. Yeah.
And it's like, much of his wealth is in the stock market, so he probably should not allow that kind of thing to happen.
Yeah, you would think he would have enough, you know, enough self-respect to realize that, but no, probably not. So here's another story. Obviously a lot of us had, like, you know, relatives who went off to war. You know, maybe they went to World War II, or they were in Vietnam, and they came back with, you know, some military stuffs with them, usually firearms of some kind. A handful of them will also sometimes have, like, grenades or something. And the thing about those grenades is they're not always dormant. When they come home, some of them are still alive, like, years after the fact. And this one Indiana man died after somebody pulled the pin on a grenade in his granddad's belongings.
Yeah. Yeah. He's dead after a grenade discovered in a grandfather's belongings was detonated.
Mm-hmm.
The family was looking through their grandfather's belongings when they found the handheld explosive device.
Mm-hmm.
And it went off. They're not saying who potentially pulled the pin.
Mm-hmm.
But if it obviously wasn't, you know, put away anywhere secure.
Mm.
Like, if you're just putting it amongst a bunch of shit, like, duct tape it, mm-hmm. the pin to there, like, wrap it all around so nobody can do anything to it.
Mm-hmm.
Something to secure it, at least. If not, put it in, you know, a safe. Something that can mostly mitigate the damage it could do.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, his two children were wounded by shrapnel and transported to a nearby hospital.
Mm.
So, unfortunately, they have lost their father. But, yeah, tragic stuff.
Mm.
But a reason why you shouldn't keep grenades amongst your belongings, like it's everything else.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you think it's not, you know, something that can go off.
Yeah. Don't ever treat this the same way you would treat a gun. Always act as if it's loaded.
Yeah.
But, yeah. Next up, a Miami Zoo got in trouble with New Zealanders advertising a Kiwi Encounter event. Oh, yes.
Yeah, this is a weird little thing. They had a Kiwi at their zoo and decided to start offering an encounter in which you could physically, like, pet the Kiwi kind of thing, which is not really a good thing to do because they are, you know, very timid creatures. They're nocturnal creatures, so pulling them out during the day is not great for them.
Mm-hmm.
And they also don't really have bones the way that a lot of birds do.
Nope.
Spine and that kind of stuff they don't have, which is why they're very prone to, you know, being close to extinction.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of thing. That's why, you know, New Zealanders very much care about Kiwis and then them being protected.
Yeah.
Would for the bald eagle.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of thing. That let's see. They have, on behalf of everyone at Zoo Miami, Please accept our most profound and sincere apology for the stress initiated by a video on social media depicting the handling and housing of Powra, the kiwi bird that is presently under our care. The concerns expressed have been taken very seriously, and as a result, effectively, the kiwi encounter will no longer be offered. It was offered as one-of-a-kind experience for, you know, hanging out with this bird kind of thing, which... And it's like a lot of animals at the zoo don't need to be handled by people. I'm not talking about like the big ones, but you know, this is the thing where it's like somehow this went through the various, you know, tiers of approval and somehow got all the way to being, you know, publicly promoted, to which, you know, the one of the managers here was very much like, yeah, this should not have happened. And yeah, saying, we give you our word, the public will never handle Powra again. You will never be subject to those types of lights again. And so, yeah, trying to, you know, zoos are about, you know, imitating their natural habitats and giving them, you know, a safe, healthy place to live and for people to learn about them.
Yes. So... So, and then we got this story out of Boston. While giving the commencement address at Boston University, Warner Brothers CEO David Zaslav got heckled like crazy. Remember, this is all happening during the writer's strike, so...
Yeah. People chanted, pay your writers. You know, the very sports chant, you know, pay your writers.
Clap, 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 clap. Yeah.
Doing that and booing him when he was talking, that kind of thing. So good to see that the people, you know, attending this graduation and protesters outside had the wherewithal to give him the welcome that he definitely deserves as one of the most highly paid CEOs in Hollywood. I think he's getting something like $200+ million.
Yeah,
I think second only to one other person. I forget which one it is in the chart that always gets posted of the most paid people. But yeah, he is a BU alum, so this is definitely going to be something that annoyed him. But yeah, he had to pause several times as students booed, chanted, and turned their backs on him. And then, yeah, especially made the grave error on Sunday. He told students how important it is to be respectful and kind. You do not tell angry college students that they need to be respectful of your exceedingly rich self. Guess what? A lot of them have big debt. And you're a rich man coming in being like, you need to be respectful of me. So yeah, there you go. He managed to, in this move, or no, not this move, in the next story here, unite guilds against him. Which is not a thing that happens very often.
No. that was pretty, that was amazing, frankly. Next up, so as you guys know, HBO Max is now just called Max. And they recently got a ton of criticism from both writers and directors guilds for putting their credits under, quote, creators, which is like, oh, fuck you.
Both of those guilds have done a lot of work to ensure they get credited appropriately. And, you know, Warner Brothers Discovery is just like, what if we don't do that? What if we just put them under creators to say they're all equal? And it's like, nope, that's not how any of that stuff works.
No, that's not what you do, not at all.
And people cited Raging Bull, where they listed, you know, Martin Scorsese alongside all the writers that worked on the movie.
Oh yes. And
it's like, good job, you're pissing off one of the most prolific directors around. As well as a movie that is, you know, highly acclaimed and popular.
Yes.
And just listing them all as creators, and it's like, technically, yes, but also they're credited specifically due to union contracts.
Yes.
And that's not supposed to change in these official capacities.
Mm-hmm.
You're specifically paid so that you can put the put these shows and movies on your service, and you're supposed to credit them correctly.
Yes. Yes, very much so.
You're probably already angering these people enough as, you know, the typical way that, you know, credit sequences get zoomed out mm-hmm. on a lot of these services to be like, hey, what do you want to watch next? Don't ignore everything that's going on behind here. We'll make it, you know, a 20th of the screen so you can't see anything here. Mm-hmm. You have to do extra work just to look at who was in the movie and who made it.
Yeah. But,
yeah, I'll, this is on top of all the technical bullshit that happened with the launch of this app. Because you didn't just have to launch up your HBO Max app, and it's just like, all right, we got an update, and now it says Max now. It's like, nope, it was a separate app. Mm-hmm. And so everybody's trying to log into it at the same time, causing it to crash and all these issues.
Mm.
It's like, man, you guys didn't learn anything from the million other times that this stuff happens.
Like, seriously. Did not learn a goddamn thing.
Yeah, they're just like, give us the money and then maybe we'll make this work.
Mm-hmm.
But now they're fixing it, so.
Yeah.
They'll get it fixed eventually, but not enough before, just adding to the anger that these guilds have.
Mm-hmm.
So congratulations, you've made everything worse.
Yep. And next up, MoviePass is officially back. Don't know anybody who was excited for that, but here we go.
Yeah, they're back to get some money.
Yep.
I don't know how much, but the new service, it's under new ownership, launching ahead of Memorial Day weekend, which is a big movie weekend.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, supposedly work at more than 4,000 theater locations across the U.S., including AMC, Regal, and Cinemark theaters.
Mm.
They are, moving away from the, $10 a month and you can watch everything as much as you want kind of thing that never made any sense financially, how that worked. This new service is tiered at $10, $20, $30, and $40 a month.
Mm-hmm.
Based on how much of the movies you want to be able to watch.
Mm-hmm.
The $10 is like 1 to 3 movies. They give you a certain amount of credits, and I guess based on probably how new the movie is, it costs different amounts of credits. It says 34 credits for that $10 tier a month. So that can probably go from 1 to 3 different movies based on, times and all that kind of stuff, whether it's at prime time hours that are more expensive versus matinee. It's probably all that kind of stuff. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
$20 gets you 3 to 7 movies a month. That's 72 credits. There's $30 for 5 to 11 a month for 113 credits, and 30 movies a month for $40 per month. One per day limit there for 640 credits. I was just like, I don't know that there's that much to even need that many, but if you're that kind of person and needs to go see a movie a day, go ahead, I guess. But, a lot of the theater chains have their own services now.
Mm-hmm.
I know at least AMC and Regal have them. Mm-hmm. Cinemark may as well. And I think those have less limits to them.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you're paying directly the chain for that privilege.
Yeah.
And they're probably assuming you buy, popcorn and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. There you go.
Yeah.
A service that probably won't be as big as it was originally, but
mm-hmm.
hey, if you are into it, cool.
Yeah. Yeah. That's your thing. Go for it. Yeah. Speaking of films, The Color Purple is getting remade as a movie. Well, actually need to correct that a little bit. There was already actually a musical made of The Color Purple that was based on the book and the movie in 2005. But now they're sort of doing it, coming full circle, and now they're remaking it as the musical. So, but yeah, it's being remade as a musical.
Yeah, it's Oprah Winfrey and Steven Spielberg are producing this, mm-hmm. directed by a newish director, Blitz Bazawule. I don't know how that's pronounced, but I assume that is a black director.
Mm-hmm.
Much like the original, a majority black cast here of a lot of people that you've probably seen in various shows and movies.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely some notable people like Taraji P. Henson, Coleman Domingo, Halle Bailey, Corey Hawkins, David Alan Greer, Sierra's in this. H.E.R. is in this. But the main star is... where's the name at here? Fantasia is reprising her Broadway role as the lead in this movie, Celie. I never seen the original movie because it was very much like by the time I learned about it, it seemed like a too old of a movie for me to watch. I don't know if you've ever seen it, Brandon.
I've read bits of the book, so yeah. I do know what happens. It's one of those books that's it can be heady reading.
Yeah. The movie was a landmark movie. It brought Steven Spielberg out of the summer blockbuster mold. He could do other things.
Yeah.
And it puts, who was it that was in that? Not Oprah Winfrey. Whoopi Goldberg put her on the map outside of being in, comedy stuff and all that beforehand.
Yeah.
But that made her a big deal in Hollywood, which has some good things and lately some not so great things. But, that's how she got into the limelight is through that movie. And that movie won an Oscar for that. So this one will be out December 25th on Christmas Day. So that's cool to see. That's out of Warner Brothers. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we also got an official trailer for the Barbie movie, which, has been just meme to hell and back pretty much since it was announced and slowly seeing bits and pieces of it coming forward.
Yeah. And this one shows more of the framework of the movie, which is that they, have fun in Barbie land. And then, Barbie starts realizing that things are getting weird and like they make a big deal of like, her trademark, high heels, feet go flat, that kind of stuff. And then she runs into like the all seeing Barbie played by Kate McKinnon, who's very much playing like the gay Barbie, I guess.
Yeah.
It's like, do you want to go find out the real world? Stay in your Barbie dreamland. Thing. And she's like, I want the high heels. She's like, no, you're going out to the real world.
Yeah.
And Ken like sneaks out with her kind of thing. And then I guess it's dealing with Mattel trying to keep the lid on the fact that Barbie's in the real world. Mm-hmm. This whole meta thing going on. That's weird, but that seems neat.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that'll be out July 21st.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And finally, last but not least, we got a teaser trailer for Netflix's Skull Island. Yep, we're going back to King Kong, folks.
Yep, an animated show, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Or movie, I don't know. They don't do anything here to tell me what it is, but it's animated.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks like pretty well done stuff, but looks like, a group of people manage to find Skull Island and do not have a good time.
Mm-hmm.
As the various, giant monsters start descending upon them before, Kong finds them.
Mm-hmm.
That whole thing. So, yeah, that'll be out June 22nd.
Mm-hmm.
So that's cool to see.
Mm.
While they're awaiting the next movie in the Godzilla King Kong universe.
Yeah.
The Monsterverse, I guess they're just calling it.
Yep. But I do believe with that, we have officially got ourselves a show. Yep. Yes, we do. We have got ourselves a show. So I would like to remind all of our listeners, if you got a question, comment, or something you want us to read on the air, you can get in contact with us at letsweekenders@gmail.com. That's letsweekenders@gmail.com. We got a link for you in the show notes. Also, on top of Apple Podcasts, you can catch our little bit of unscripted shenanigans at TuneIn, Google Play, RSS, archive.org, or pretty much any kind of podcast aggregator you can think of. So, yeah, we're going to go ahead and wind it down here for tonight. If you liked what you heard, please do not hesitate to share with, you know, your friends, your family, casual acquaintances, mortal enemies, basically anyone who will listen to you. And hopefully it won't end up as bad as all the shit that's going down with the GOP in Texas, because, yeah, there is blood in the water, and they are getting ready to tear each other to pieces. And I will be watching with popcorn, because there are a bunch of awful people, and I can't wait to watch them suffer. But until then, we will be back next week at the usual time, hopefully. I don't know that yet, but hopefully at the usual time. If not, it will be for Friday again. But until then, we'll see you all next week. Good night, everybody.